I'm going to turn the meeting over to Bob McGrath, and he will introduce our speakers.
Thanks, John. In the spring of 2015, Senior Statesman of Virginia sponsored a program titled Growth Versus No Growth. We had Tim Hulbert, who's president of the Charlottesville Regional Chamber of Commerce, and Tom Olivier, who's sitting there, who's president of ASAP, which stands for Advocates for a Sustainable Albemarle Population, debating the issue. Now, the Daily Progress report on the program included a Hulbert quote, "If you limit building, you create a situation where people who can't afford to live here will buy property, and that could raise the cost of people, raise the cost for people who grew up here. There is a constancy in natural economic forces, and a rising economic tide will float all boats." Now, of course, the Daily Progress report also gave us Olivier's comments, and his first comment was that a rising tide is creating a flood of tax needs on local governments and residents, and specifically, he said, the county's actually having to raise taxes now to deal with the population growth of the past. It's time for Charlottesville and Albemarle County to find a right-size population in our community. Now today, we're fortunate to have two people who actually carry major leadership and executive responsibility for managing growth in our county. They're going to give us their views on taxes, growth, and our Albemarle County quality of life. Our first speaker is Liz Palmer, who many of you know. She's chair of the County Board of Supervisors. She was elected in 2013 to represent the Samuel Miller District. Prior to that, she served for 8 years on the Albemarle County Service Authority. She's been a practicing veterinarian for many years in our community. Tim Keller serves as the at-large commissioner and chair of the Albemarle County Planning Commission. He's a professor emeritus of landscape architecture at Iowa State University and a founding principal of Land and Community Associates located in Charlottesville. Now, Liz and Tim are both very busy. We're very glad they could squeeze us into their busy calendar. And so now let's welcome them and hear what they have to say.
First, I'm going to take a drink of water. So thank you very, very much for having us here today. We very much appreciate the opportunity, and we very much appreciate the fact that you changed your regular day to accommodate us. I want to note that we have some other members of our Board of Supervisors here today. We have Diantha McKeel from the Jack Jewett District. And I think I saw somebody, we have Norman Dill from the Ravana District. And are there any more supervisors here that I can't see? I guess not, but thank you for coming here. So when Bob first asked me about doing this, I sat and thought about, well, who is the best person to do this talk? And then I thought, what better than a supervisor who's relatively new on the board? I've been here about 3 years. I'm in my third year. And as you get on the board of supervisors, I'm sure my other supervisors can attest to this, that you immediately get engrossed in budgets and you try to figure out what's the big picture? Where are we going here? And because I've been doing that for the last 3 years, I thought I would be a good person to explain to folks that are in similar situations that I was about 4 years ago. And I hope that turns out to be right. Then I decided to ask Tim Keller because of his position on the Planning Commission as chair, and also because of his many years of experience in planning. But there's another reason, and that's because I have learned that in Virginia, Albemarle County Board of Supervisors are to great extent zoning bodies. That's the primary tool that our state government gives to us. So I meant to start advancing these things right from the start, but then I forgot. So moving along, my very first thing I'm going to show you is the disclaimer. Our views are our own and do not necessarily represent the views of the Board of Supervisors or the Planning Commission. The Board of Supervisors is in the process of updating the strategic plan and invites continued input. I put that up there because we do invite continued input, but also because we're going to talk about one strategy, for instance, the RIO 29 Small Area Plan, that's already been adopted by the Board and is in the process of being completed now. But we're also going to talk about a strategy that involves more detailed planning, which is not something that the Board of Supervisors has discussed at this point, but is something that I find particularly intriguing. So, the effects of population growth. Well, if anybody has lived here for 10 years or longer, they know what changes have taken place here. We've had tremendous changes. There's some positive effects of population growth. We get a more diverse community with increased cultural and educational and job opportunities. But we also see those negatives. We see increased road traffic in both the urban and the rural areas, deterioration of air and water quality, loss of open space and agricultural land, and increased property taxes. And yes, increased property taxes are something that a lot of people don't necessarily directly equate with growth, but I'm hoping to show you today that it really does. We all enjoy the fact, I think we all do, anyway I do, that we can drive just a short distance outside of town and be in the rural areas. It's beautiful. We can do that because in 1980, our community developed strong development lines, and we've kept that up over all those years. We've made sure that that growth management strategy, that we adhere to that. Tim Keller. Tim is going to talk about the history of that a little bit and the consequences of that. But then there's other people that really complain that this growth management plan holds back business and thereby really hurts people's abilities to make a living. They also believe it's driving up land prices and making our economy, our county increasingly unaffordable. So what our talk is going to do is going to concentrate on what local government can do to balance these competing concerns and what kind of economic development will really help the budget without stoking growth. You'll see that Tim and I believe that economic development is best done in tight conjunction with urban infill and revitalization. So I'm going to take about 20 minutes to go through my part, which I'm going to deal with money and taxes, and then I'm going to turn it over to Tim to talk about planning and the kinds of things we can do to actually deal with some of these negative impacts. So what we did was we divided this into three parts, our discussion points. The first one is, does growth pay for itself? That is, do local taxes paid by the average family in a single-family home cover the cost of services provided by local government? Our answer is no. Growth does not pay for growth. The second, Steve, is, does local government possess the tools to mitigate the negative impacts of growth on our taxes, environment, and quality of life? Our answer is yes, but ultimately we're going to need state help and tax reform. The third is, can urban infill and redevelopment help us maintain our Albemarle County quality of life in the face of population growth and increased property taxes? And our answer to that is yes. Planning, economic, and land use is our primary tool that will help us preserve our Albemarle County identity and quality of life. So, moving on, for the first discussion point, growth does not pay for itself. And again, the local taxes paid by the average family in a single-family home do not cover the cost of services provided by local government. So how can I say that? Well, first, what we really need to do is find the break-even point. And the break-even point is the assessed value of a single-family home at which the real property tax revenue generated by that home equals the net cost of the public goods and services provided by the county to the people that live in that home. And what the county does to try to figure that out is we have a cost revenue impact model called the CRIM. And this is a very detailed model. There's a lot of models out there to use. No models are perfect, but this one is a very detailed one. It has hundreds of inputs in it. I've shown here the major revenues and costs. It does have a factor included for growth. Interestingly, we only do the census every 10 years, but we do have an idea of how many homes are built. We also have water connections, and so we can figure out approximately how many people we can expect in future years. And it turns out that it very consistently is about 1,400 to 1,500 people every year that we get to our community. And so what we do is we do this calculation, and based on the 2015 real estate rate of 82 cents, the taxable value break-even point for a single-family home is $622,000, which generates about $5,100 in real estate taxes. Now, I don't have time to go into all the detail of this model, but I can say that with an average value of homes in Albemarle County, it's about $300,000. So you can pretty much say that we're not getting too close to that, at least at this point. So what I've done is tried to pick one thing out of one factor out of the CRIM model to try to illustrate this, and I took student enrollment. Obviously, education is one of our biggest expenses. So you can see from this model that we have about 1,000 more students now than we did in 2008. Jack Jewett Middle School has about 600 kids. So we've got enough new students here to fill a middle school and another elementary school. That's pretty astounding when you think about it. Now, what does it cost to educate a child? Well, in Albemarle County, it costs about $12,000. And you can see from this that we're pretty much in the middle of where other communities are with the cost of educating a child. So we're doing a pretty good job. We're not out of line with other communities. The state will give us about $3,600 a year per pupil to educate that child. So we have to come up with about $8,500 for every individual child. And so not too many people's real estate tax bills can cover that kind of cost. And you might say, well, not all households have children. But it's really the average cost that we figured out in the CRIM. And so we have we've taken into consideration those people without any children. So I added this slide because this is the 10 most populous counties in Virginia. And you can see it pretty much goes right along with population, the tax rate. And I'll mention in our favor, those asterisks represent counties that have special tax districts. Those are districts that are put in place for particular things like new parks or sidewalks or something like that in specific areas. We don't have any special tax districts. So when you look at a place like Fairfax or Prince Williams, a lot of the people in those counties are actually paying more than that tax rate. So that brings us to the next question. Does local government possess the tools to help mitigate the negative effects of population growth on taxes, our environment, and our quality of life? Well, we're saying yes. But it ultimately needs state help and tax reform. So how can I say that? Well, in order to answer that, see if I can get this going, we really have to look at our total county revenues. And you can see from this that the property taxes are a big chunk of our revenues. The state revenue, that 22% there, is predominantly schools and state mandates. We don't have much discretion over that at all. So if we take a look at those things that we actually can affect, which is our local revenues, we take a little closer look at that, we see how dependent we really are on a general property tax. I want to say something about that sales tax figure. That's $15 million is the sales tax we get from our entire county. It's all the commercial activity in the county. A lot of people think that when we get a Costco in, we're going to see some big jump in our revenues. But given that it's only $15 million, I say only $15 million, that's a lot of money for me, but in a $375 million budget, it's not large. And we only get one penny of the state five-penny tax on the dollar. So if we drill down a little deeper and look at that real estate tax, we can see that almost all of our property tax does come from real estate. That local personal property tax you see up there, a big chunk of that is the car tax. It also includes business personal property. So if this is the case, what can we do to increase revenue? Well, we can increase the real estate tax. We all know that. That'll get us more money. If the assessments go up, we all have to pay more real estate tax, so that will get us more. But that really doesn't help mitigate the problems, the impacts on the residential home payer, real estate payer. And that's really what the Board of Supervisors, one of the many things the Board of Supervisors is really concerned about, and I think most of us are concerned about it. We want to give some relief or at least slow the growth of the tax rate. So what can we do? Well, if we look at what the state will allow us to do, the state controls our ability to tax. We cannot collect an income tax. We get one penny of the state's five-penny sales tax. Unlike cities, we can't raise the hotel tax over 4 cents per dollar and must give everything over two cents to promote tourism. For example, we give money to the Charlottesville Albemarle Visitors Bureau. We can't raise the meals tax over 4 cents. We cannot tax cigarettes. In addition, we have to charge businesses the same rate, business and commercial property the same rate as we do residential. Not that we would want to do that. I think the business community would be pretty angry with us if we started upping their tax rate without upping the residential, but we can't do that anyway. The state doesn't allow us to do it. So one of the things that we hear, that I hear certainly as a local representative, is the way to solve our budget woes is to have economic development that concentrates on jobs. Just like we hear in the real estate business, it's location, location, location. Most of the people that are involved in economic development say jobs, jobs, jobs. But we have a 3.6% unemployment rate. And if growth doesn't pay for growth, then a job-centric economic development plan is not necessarily going to help our bottom line. Now, I think all of us agree that jobs, that better quality jobs, help lift individuals' quality of life, and nobody's going to argue with that. But my point is, does it really help our bottom line? So why do we keep hearing this? And I added this slide, if I can get it going here, to show that the state, the general fund of the state, is what the General Assembly has the most discretion over. And they get their income from individual income tax and sales tax. And so you can see right off the bat that this job-centric economic development strategy does help the state, but it doesn't necessarily help us. So what should we do? So I put this slide up here to show you where we get our real estate tax revenue. It's predominantly from residential. This slide shows, it's from the land book, it shows the values, the percent values of land in our county, which correlates pretty closely to what we're getting in revenue. So the idea that has come up, has been suggested to us, is that what we try to do is focus shifting that percentage of residential tax over into the commercial. How can we do that? Is that a solution? So we increase the residential real estate, residential real estate revenue per acre in our development area. And that's what we've been looking at quite a bit lately. There's some ways to do that. And this is where I'm going to turn it over to Tim for our third one. Can urban infill and redevelopment help us maintain our quality, our Albemarle County quality of life in the face of population growth and increased property taxes? And we're saying that planning, economic and land use, is a primary tool to get there, to help us preserve our quality of life and identity. And at that, I'm going to turn it over to Tim. You use this right here. See that blue button? Just press, point it and press the blue
button.
Can
I double click for the video? Is that correct? When I get to that. Great. Thanks. Okay. Now we're working on the transition here.
Quickly. Oh, you have to quickly go through these.
But this isn't, this is the end.
Ah. Just quickly go through those. Here, let me see. Catch it
to yours. Okay, we're out of.
I'll go through my extra slides. We didn't take those out. Okay, here we go. That's where you start.
All right. So we've already had Liz share this one with us, and I'm still trying to push this button. The Albemarle County Growth Management Plan is successful, I believe. The rural is still rural. Development is primarily directed to the growth areas. Okay. Interesting. We're rolling. Continuing our current planning policies while addressing additional urban design-focused planning tools and techniques will, I believe, allow us to maintain our region's high quality of life in the face of population growth. When my family moved back to Central Virginia in 1953, after both my parents served in the Pacific Theater during World War II, Charlottesville had a population of 26,000 and Albemarle County had a population of 27,000. Today, the city has grown to 48,000 and the county to 103,000. Our metro area, that also includes Fluvanna, Greene, and Nelson counties, has a population of 241,000 people. When we reach 250, we will have entered into the second largest metropolitan category that the federal government uses to talk about the rural-urban continuum. People that grow up here, move here, and visit here know that there's something special about our Central Virginia Piedmont and its adjacent Blue Ridge Mountains. Our city and county contain the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello and the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, a portion of the Shenandoah National Park, the southern end of the Skyline Drive, and the northern terminus of the Blue Ridge Parkway, a portion of the Appalachian Trail, and tens of thousands of hectares of protected agricultural and forested lands, as well as 85 nationally and or state listed historic properties, districts, and landscapes. These places exist within a larger landscape composed of living communities that continue to evolve over time. The Albemarle landscape we experience today is primarily the legacy landscape of four centuries of agricultural land uses and activities in a hill and valley landscape. In addition to its rural areas, Albemarle County contains urban and urbanizing areas both within it and adjacent to it that form part of the regional context. The University of Virginia began development in 1817 on a site 1.8 miles west of the courthouse and Charlottesville's small urban core, on a site that was completely surrounded by rural plantations. With the University of Virginia growing steadily since World War II, much of the population increase and economic growth of Charlottesville-Albemarle are directly or indirectly attributable to the growth of the University of Virginia and the industries and enterprises that develop as related services to or take advantage of its proximity for economic gain. We like to brag about our high quality of life to our friends who live elsewhere and to businesses considering relocating to our area. Our 2013 county resident survey points to a populace that considers many quality of life factors quite high compared to other localities, and its perception is supported by state and national rankings as one of the healthiest Virginia counties, an internationally ranked wine region destination, great agritourism, great local food, great college town, great place to retire with great food and beer. In 2014, domestic travelers spent $22.4 billion on transportation, lodging, food, amusement, and recreation, as well as retail shopping in Virginia. A recent study by Virginia Commonwealth University for Preservation, Virginia, attributes 85% of the state's tourism to heritage tourism, and we certainly have a great number of such destinations here in Central Virginia. Agriculture, at $54 billion annually, is the largest sector of Virginia's economy. We keep hearing about other sectors, but it's still agriculture. And with the Commonwealth's emphasis on supporting agritourism, wineries, breweries, and distilleries, the number of farms and the acreage and farmland continue to increase, not decrease, increase, in Albemarle County. In the latest agricultural census, Albemarle County moved to the second highest county producer of fruit and also near the top in hay, horses, goats, and sheep. So how did we get to this point? How did this happen? Was it just dumb luck? Was there vision and planning involved? Albemarle County's private and public planning efforts have assisted in both maintaining and improving the quality of life for its citizens. Let's consider our Albemarle County planning history, and to do that effectively, we cannot leave out our planning relationship with our partners, the City of Charlottesville and the University of Virginia. Obviously, the private sector has been a major player in these efforts. Local realtors have actively promoted Albemarle County in the Central Virginia region as a place for affluent land investors, retirees, socialites, and celebrities to enjoy a scenic and rural landscape near the nation's capital. Albemarle and Charlottesville individually and collectively have promoted tourism for more than a century and worked individually and collectively with the support of local businesses, NGOs, and the Commonwealth of Virginia to promote cultural resources as one of the major ways to build and maintain a healthy economy based on agriculture, tourism, and economic development. Historically, annexations were a form of planning. Charlottesville has annexed portions of Albemarle 9 times since 1762 to reach its current size of 26.6 square kilometers. Annexations were not friendly, and some were particularly contentious because of lost county tax revenues and changed school district boundaries. Rather than continuing to build or merge as some jurisdictions have done, the two jurisdictions entered into negotiations that resulted in their 1982 annexation and revenue sharing agreement, with the city agreeing to no future annexation in return for an annual portion of county tax revenues. This choice allowed each to address growth, change, and preservation in the rural urban continuum on their own terms, but with an interrelated framework. The agreement effectively froze the city at its 1968 boundaries and led me from McIntyre School, where I attended school, to the first class graduating from Greenbrier in the city, as a sidebar. Taking much of the autocentric suburban development associated with World War II dreams of our returning veterans. Thus, the city would have to increase density and build up and not out if it wished to continue to increase its population or its tax base. The county could plan for its own growth without the concern of losing those newly developing areas adjacent to the city through future annexations. While Albemarle County and the City of Charlottesville did not go so far as to merge schools or police and safety operations, they did develop a joint water and sewer authority to plan for and manage those services. As concern grew over the sprawl from increasing suburban development in the county's more rural areas, elected officials with citizen input developed a comprehensive plan that called for defining areas of growth, particularly around the city, and areas to remain rural. To accomplish this, a comprehensive rezoning occurred in 1980. Although numerous lawsuits challenged the changes, judicial courts upheld the new zoning ordinance and map. From this point forward, land in the rural area developed at a much lower density than land in the urban growth areas. This policy was strengthened with a decision to only allow water and sewer lines in the growth areas and to only provide other lesser services such as police and fire protection to the rural areas. For the first time, there was a policy to maintain the county's rural qualities as well as a policy to encourage growth in defined urban areas. Since the revenue sharing agreement, the city of Charlottesville has concentrated on addressing redevelopment of underutilized areas, higher density infill development, increased numbers of historic districts, natural area protection, and expanded trails and parks. Its downtown pedestrian mall has grown into a third major visitor attraction along with Monticello and the University of Virginia. The city's investment in the mall encouraged related development, including the West End Anchor Hotel, the East End Anchor Event Pavilion, transit center, and parking garages, as well as building rehabilitations and new construction. New development on and near the downtown mall is subject to design review that protects the cultural values of the historic Central Business District. And the reason that I'm pushing, showing so much of this, is that the density model and the density interest for areas that many people use as their examples for what they would like to see in areas around the city are based on what they see as and value as positive in downtown Charlottesville. And this, I guess, is beginning to get us towards that piece. And a highly successful weekly farmers market downtown has spawned new high-rise adjacent development. This cohesive, high-density, mixed-use core provides a successful pattern for other future developments in the county as well as the city. Similarly, Albemarle County has adopted a neighborhood model of development for its growth areas. This model allows the county development to implement urban as well as suburban land use policies and regulations by allowing for increased density and mixed uses and supporting the county commitment to keeping the rural landscape character of its non-growth areas. In 1986, the University of Virginia, In 1986, the University of Virginia joined both Charlottesville and Albemarle in a three-party agreement for collaborative planning, and the university agreed to subject much of the land to local regulations. And this is the growth areas and the rural areas. And these are the areas where there, I think most of you would know that the city and the county both have university representatives who are non-voting sitting on there. Planning commissions and the university's planning group has representation from both the city and the county. Albemarle's growth management plan is simple in concept. Rural area protection for 95% of the county lands and focused growth areas of development in the remaining 5%. The rural areas have less services because they have a smaller population, and the growth areas have more services due to their population density. This quick trip through planning history brings us to today. Would some folks like to see more development and less controls? Of course. Would others like to see little or no change? Of course. Albemarle County's growth management approach provides a reasonable middle ground. The current rural areas policy has proven effective. The number of housing startups in the rural areas has remained more or less constant over the last several decades, while the number of households in the growth areas continue to increase. Since the current growth management approach was implemented, the population in the growth area has increased at a higher rate than in the rural areas. And today, close to half of the county residents live in the growth areas. Thus, the majority of the county residents live in a more concentrated, dense manner, leaving the majority of the rural land to its traditional dispersed settlement pattern. The rural areas are facing change, though. The increase in success of local agriculture due to the growth of the local food movement, wineries, cideries, breweries, and distilleries, and their value-added activities involving farm visits, product picking and tastings, and events such as concerts and weddings have resulted in increased activity and traffic. While most folks are excited by the increased agricultural productivity in Albemarle County, there's concern voiced over new pressures on the rural infrastructure. County planners are working with agriculturists and other rural stakeholders to address the resulting issues, such as rural road congestion and safety, and event-generated noise spilling into onto adjacent properties that this economic success brings. When all regulations and incentives are considered together and mapped, the majority of land in Albemarle's rural area has one or more sets of development review. These land use reviews, in tandem with state and local policies that preference agriculture, provide potentially strong support for the sustainability of these rural areas. The areas in green in the county have one, in many cases, multiple areas in which there's review, and planners will be interacting with the citizen over contemplated changes. But what of our growth areas? This is our current challenge. Many Albemarle County citizens agree that integrated land use and economic development planning now must focus on the growth areas if we're to maintain our high quality of life. Because of the fiscal constraints of the last several years brought on by the economic downturn, there's not been sufficient funding provided through the county's CIP, Capital Improvement Plan, process for the proposed small area urban design and detailed neighborhood planning efforts. Many of these projects called for by staff and requested by planning commissioners and supervisors are now beginning to be added to the staff work plans and funded for consultant services. City centers around the world are increasing in population through in-migration from the suburbs and countryside. This is the trend in the USA as well. Hipster millennials and baby boomer retirees are streaming back into the cities. Young and old alike desire high-density, mixed-use neighborhoods where all activities are within a short walking distance. The response to this phenomenon ranges from rehabilitating historic structures with often associated residential displacement and the infill development of new units for residents and businesses. The displaced individuals are often moving to the adjoining suburbs where housing is less expensive and businesses are left, and we're seeing that in Albemarle County from Charlottesville. This is interesting. So this was to be Herb's piece. I don't know. Maybe it does. Cool. Okay. Simply stated, the reworking and infilling of our growth areas.
I missed it.
Well, this will stand for it. Simply stated, the reworking and infilling of our growth areas is the challenge for the development and redevelopment of Albemarle County. Crozet has the benefit of a historic core, albeit small, to build upon. Other growth areas must endeavor to modify and or change form and use to meet the expectations of its current and future residents, businesses, and workplaces. Let's look at one of our current small area planning efforts. Okay, this is going to be an interesting test here. Double click.
Yep. Well, there's this one.
Okay. We were going to do a 3-minute video from the county planning staff, just so that you can get a sense.
Sixty years ago, the intersection of Ryer Road and US 29 was a rural crossroads with a few houses and stores. Who would have thought then that this same intersection would grow into the urban heart of Albemarle's largest commercial corridor? It begs the question, what will this area look like in another 60 years? The new Rye Road grade-separated intersection and its connection to the John Warner Parkway and the new Northside Library on West Rye Road are only the beginning of redevelopment in this area. New private sector projects in the pipeline will add more retail and housing. Now is the perfect time for the community to reflect on what it wants this area to look like, not just in 60 years, but in 5, 10, or 20 years. In order to articulate a vision for this area and to better plan for this redevelopment, the county has recently begun the work of developing a small area plan. Small area plans are a planning tool used to guide land use, zoning, transportation improvements, open space, and other capital improvements at a higher level of detail than is possible in other planning documents, like master plans or the comprehensive plan. Because of that, a small area plan can identify and address specific local conditions and opportunities for revitalization and mixed-use development. The small area plan will allow land uses and the design of road improvements to be coordinated, and for the business owners and residents of the planning area to participate in the planning process. The small area plan will expand upon the recommendations from the comprehensive plan and the Places 29 master plan, which calls for the intersection of Rye Road and US 29 to redevelop into a vibrant mixed-use area. The small area plan will include a more detailed, desired land use plan and urban design recommendations, and it will provide a more concrete vision about what this area could look like. Once adopted, the small area plan will become part of the county's comprehensive plan and the Places 29 master plan. The small area plan will be completed in two phases. Phase 1 includes an analysis of the study area, a market assessment, and will result in a preferred land use alternative for the study area. The county received a grant from the Office of Intermodal Transportation and Investment for the completion of Phase 1, which has allowed the county to work with a consultant, Renaissance Planning, to do this work. Phase 1 will wrap up in early 2017. Phase 2 will include a final land use plan, an urban design plan, a transportation plan, and an implementation action plan. Once complete, the final small area plan document will be adopted as part of the Places 29 master plan and the comprehensive plan. Completion for Phase 2 is anticipated at the end of 2017, and adoption of the new small area plan should occur shortly thereafter. In order to make the RIO 29 small area plan a successful and viable planning tool, it is essential to have participation from you, our community, throughout the planning process. We want to hear from you about your desires and vision for this area. There are many ways to get involved. Please join us at a public event or send us a comment through email, Facebook, or Twitter. For more information, visit www.albemarle.org/RIO29SAP. Be a part of creating the vision to transform this important area of the county.
So from a planning perspective, there's an immediate need to develop focused small area plans and an interconnected network of livable mixed-use neighborhoods where a wide variety of individuals and families can live, work, and go to school, recreate, and shop while moving about by foot and by bicycle as well as by automobile. Here we are again. We're going to get ourselves out of this. Aha! So this is where we are at this point, as you see from this work that's in progress. But within the development community, the design and planning community, and actually encouraged by our supervisors, staff is also investigating some other mechanisms. And one of those is form-based code. This is an interesting new planning tool that's more or less been formed since the heydays of the development of the growth management plan for the county that was really viewed in many, and still is viewed in many areas as a model, both in Virginia and nationally, for growth management. So let's talk about this form-based code for a moment. Form-based codes are a response to the past half century of urban development where regulations have been concerned with controlling land uses rather than shaping the physical form of our communities. The code contains standards that are regulatory, not advisory. form-based codes with their generous illustrations and simple diagrams clearly convey a community's intentions for an area. SBSs are designed for quick and convenient understanding. In Virginia, Arlington County has used form-based code since 2003 in efforts to re-envision and revitalize a major transportation corridor, Columbia Pike. And I think that that is really why folks in this area are interested, because of our transportation corridors, well, let's say corridors, 250 as well as 29. While the addition of form-based code may ultimately assist developers, staff, and citizens in giving a new, more livable form to Albemarle County neighborhoods within growth areas, the successful process will require significant upfront effort in developing future urban design plans and area-specific codes in order to guarantee that the form-based code will work well at the final stages of the development approvals. So as you can see, it's not something that takes the place, really, of what we're doing and where we are in this process right now. But developers in particular, and I think neighborhood groups that have been through it in successful communities like Nashville, believe that there, a lot of the haggling occurs up front. And then there's the opportunity, once that code is in place, to be able to work more quickly through the process after that. That's the intent anyway. But I need to make crystal clear that this is not something that we have in Albemarle County right now. It is a tool that we are exploring and may be a possibility in the future. So today there is a market for mixed-use, high-density, and less auto-centric neighborhoods. We've seen it across the country. We see it in downtown Charlottesville. These can be the results of rehabilitation and infill of an existing historic area, like downtown Charlottesville or Crozet Town Center. It could also be the result of revisioning and infilling a non-historic suburban area, such as Shoppers World Shopping Center here on 29, or the construction of totally new communities and neighborhoods like Old Trail Village. The result in each case is a higher density, mixed-use neighborhood that will require reduced infrastructure and public service investment, and therefore can generate higher taxes per acre. And this is an example that City Councilor Kathy Galvin did on approved and built projects in the West Main area. And you can just get a sense from this that because of the density of these developments, there is a significantly higher tax return coming from a significantly smaller geographic area. And with that, the three discussion points. And so, Liz, you want to come on up?
Yeah. At this point, we were just going to take questions, and we were just going to show our three discussion points so that if anybody wants to look at them and ask questions about it, and we will hear from you.
Getting developers, the proffers, the thinking behind it, how it's determined.
The wonderful world of proffers.
I can make an attempt. Oh, there it goes. I said the wonderful world of proffers. Everybody knows that recently, I think everybody knows that the state legislature recently changed the rules on us with respect to proffers. There's some things that people don't understand about proffers. They are only for rezonings. So anybody can go in the state of Virginia and do a by right development and not have to give any proffers. That's one of the downsides. What we were doing, where we were looking at impacts from redevelopment for developers that wanted to rezone, and we would ask, we can't ask them, they have to offer, excuse me. They offer for that rezoning to give certain, to mitigate certain impacts. of that development. They may put a sidewalk, give some land for a school, do something like that. They also had an affordable housing figure that we would, 15% of the houses in a development would go to affordable housing. What the Virginia State Legislature did last year was they passed a law that said that all of the impacts from that development, the proffers that we received, had to be directly related to that development. So let's just say that a development is going to put in a whole lot of homes. It's expected to generate maybe 300 children for an elementary school. And if they give us the land and it's enough land for a 600 student school, we can't take that extra. And if they say, oh, no, please, take it, and we do take it, and then after the fact they decide that it really wasn't what they wanted to do or something changed, they could take us to court and say, we gave you too much. And the rule, apparently, which is very hard to make me understand, but if the judge rules in their favor, we have to give the whole proffer back. We can't do a percentage. So number one, proffers are not looking as attractive to us as they were just last year. But the other thing is that we have to remember that they're only for rezonings. They're not for by right, and a lot of our development is by right. So one of the things that I like about this more definite way to develop, I should say, this more increased detail in the planning, is that you tell the developer exactly what you want up front. You know, this is what you get. And when they come in, it's actually easier for them. It actually costs them less because they don't have to go through the Planning Commission, the Board of Supervisors. They don't have to get special permits, variances, all those kinds of things, which adds uncertainty to their project and also adds an awful lot of time, and time is money. So if I answered that, I hope. Okay.
There are two large developments going by being built at the junction of 250 and Route 20. It takes us five lights to take a left now on 20 to 250. Where are all those cars going to go from those two developments? Cascadia and Riverfront, very high rent district, I think.
Cascadia, are you familiar with those particular ones? Will you take that one?
Well, it sounds like making excuses, but the reality is that a lot of the decisions that are bringing us developments today, those decisions were made a long time ago. And so we find ourselves... It has to be that close? Okay. All right. We find ourselves having to continue what our predecessors in the planning commissions before and the supervisors before approved. One of the issues that the development community constantly brings forward is how long it takes to make a lot of these projects happen. And at least nationally, there seems to be some willingness, and that's what is interesting about some of these newer, more urban-oriented planning tools and techniques, would be that we would have more agreement up front, and then that would expedite, if we could have more agreement up front, that would expedite the process. But I think any of us that have come from community groups and are involved in community groups today know that it's still going to be difficult to come to some degree of consensus about projects on the up front, just as it is on the back end.
But surely they thought about the roads when they got that tradition years ago before you were there.
They did, and because in the counties, VDOT is in effect our transportation engineer. VDOT owns the roads, except for in special cases where the developers and the supervisors then approve the roads to not be officially part of the state network. If the state is giving their best advice that there's not a problem, And that has been the case consistently and continues to this day to be the case. But just one other, one quick point on this. What we're talking about is a suburban style development that doesn't have the same degree of density. And I think that the suburbs that we started in this country in the 1880s and 1890s that hit their high point post-World War II in the last century are a land use form that is evolving to something different that is not as automobile oriented today. And the projects from this point on, I believe we will see around the country to have to be denser, more compact, with generations, younger generations that are more interested in moving about in ways other than with cars.
Can I just want to add one thing to yours really quickly, if I could. This is an example in very close to my district, which I'm more familiar with. We recently, everybody knows about the Crozet Master Plan. I don't know if they do, but we have a Crozet Master Plan. And there's a tremendous amount of growth taking place in Crozet. It's affecting 250 West. And my constituents are constantly complaining, and rightly so, about you can't make a left turn onto 250 West. I actually have a meeting after this with some neighbors who are looking for wanting a light at Tillman and 250. We recently had a development proposed in the development area right up around Miller School Road and 250 West. And the developer did everything right. They followed the rules. They gave the proper, they had the amount of affordable housing that was reasonable, and it was a rezoning. And I voted against it. And even though in the master plan it said that was the density that was supposed to be. So the developer did everything right, but I voted against it. The reason why I voted against it was because VDOT said it was fine. VDOT said, oh, no, it's not going to cause undue traffic. The by right, they can still develop by right and get several homes in there. But I voted against it because right now we're looking at road improvements that we have to pay for three roundabouts on 250 West. And that's a lot of money. This is not... I'm showing this to show the disconnect between planning and what VDOT approves. And I know that doesn't help you when you talk about five lights, but one of the conundrums that we are constantly faced with is properties that you can develop by right or that are planned for a certain amount of density, and we have no control over the roads. So it doesn't help your question, but it gives you an example of some of the problems that we're dealing with.
There's a tendency to monetize every value, to look at things strictly in terms of revenues they can create or profits that they can create. I'm concerned about another category of land use, which would be none at all, where you allow a natural area to remain free from human intervention so that ecologically necessary areas could be maintained, and so that there would be migratory pathways through the county, particularly as species are responding to climate change and global warming. So does the county have any tools to say these areas will not be intruded upon for any human use, including agriculture, in order to protect the environment, particularly areas that could absorb flood rainfalls or could prevent erosion that would cause silting into our reservoirs?
Would you like to take that, or would you like me to take that?
You take it, and I'll
find it. Okay. So there is some people in the room that know an awful lot about our Natural Heritage Committee, which has been working for many, many, many years and had a bit of a dry spell during the recession years. But we do have now a natural resource manager that we hired just 2 years ago, actually a year ago, came on board. And we're looking at developing maps to try to identify those areas and figure out ways to try to protect them. Land is owned by private individuals in Virginia, and we can't necessarily tell a rural area owner that they have to do one thing or another with their property. We do have wonderful, we have better rules than a lot on buffers, on streams, critical slopes protection, that sort of thing. I personally would like to see a lot more, and I very much supported having that natural resource manager hired and to get the Natural Resource Committee back on board and working hard. So I think that's kind of a work in progress as we look at this. We also have an open space conservation land use option also for people who want to do that, which is a whole other big subject. Would you like to add to that?
Well, I would just say my heart is with you. If you can muster the populace to move forward with expanding the corridors that we do have, I think it would be wonderful. I appreciate that black bear that somehow finds its way from the Blue Ridge Parkway all the way over to my Ashlawn area along tributaries, and we know that that's a male that's been pushed out and of his folks' territory, and that's where he ended up. So, yeah. But I think given the property rights nature that we have and the pushback that we're seeing on environmental controls all over, it's difficult.
Thank you. I'd like to basically follow on what Bob just said, and I want to say as a biologist, the current growth management policy simply does not protect the rural areas. Every year in recent years, we've added about 200 residences to the rural areas. There are tens of thousands of still unused development rights in the rural areas. And if current trends continue, we're looking at decades of degradation of water quality, habitat fragmentation, breaking up migration corridors, and so on under the current growth management policy. And I want to suggest that what the county really should do, and as ASAP has suggested, is we have to recognize that the growth we're having right now is a problem, and the county should begin trying to figure out ways or seek means to, in fact, slow the current growth rate so that we can keep the things we value around here so much. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's one of the reasons why we're trying to make the development area a more attractive place to live, not only because the people in the development area want to live in a more attractive place, but we're also trying to encourage people to live there rather than the rural areas.
Liz, I'd like to talk about quality of jobs. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the unemployment rate is 3.6%. As you know, the unemployment rate can mask a lot of unpleasant truths.
Yes.
If I, for example, am stuck in a low-paying part-time job because I cannot find a good-paying full-time job, I'm regarded as employed. If the situation is so bad I give up work, I'm not regarded as unemployed. Now, I look at your infill and your redevelopment, and all I'm seeing is retail and hospitality. And those are the two lowest paying, lowest career types of jobs there are. Now, what are you going to do about other jobs? We have, I read the other day, 200 county high school graduates a year graduating with no intention of going to college. What kind of jobs are we going to have for them?
So what I was talking about in mine was really taxes and how that how growth doesn't pay for growth. So I really, and I think I did mention that I think we can all agree that quality of jobs is important. But we also have to, and we have our two economic development people here in the audience together today, who are looking at the types of jobs that we're trying to attract into those areas of redevelopment. And we're hoping we can get some other types of jobs. We do have a pretty fast-growing tech community here. We do have a lot of folks who would very much like to stay here, graduating from the University of Virginia. And we are looking at different ways to try to keep some of those folks around who start businesses in the area. We've also asked that our development group, our two development group people who are here today, that they really focus on developing those businesses that are here right now in order to help grow those businesses and employ some of the folks. Now, I will say for a lot of people, and this doesn't help you with respect to your question, but a lot of people do work in different areas. So we have a regional job market in this area. We're lucky that we do that. So, Dave, yeah.
I have a question about the costs associated with residential development, which you cited, the $622,000 cost per resident. Since most of our arithmetic growth in school-age students has come since we last built some of the school-based infrastructure, and since we don't really have an extensive stormwater management system in place already, just to use two prominent examples, given that on both of those cases you're likely to reach what I call capacity thresholds, mm-hmm. aren't we in some respects, since we're using historic data to come up with those cost figures, not future estimated data, aren't we understating the costs to some extent?
A lot of people believe very strongly that our cost revenue impact model is doing just that, that next increment of capacity that you talk about. We are there on a variety of different things. We talk about the schools. We've been told by the school, by the school board, that we are not quite ready to build a whole new school, but that we certainly need enlargement of schools. And so it's an argument for that model. Many, many people have told me that they believe that model underestimates the true cost of growth. But it's what we have in the county at this point, and no model is perfect. And I suspect there's some folks on the other side of the line that say that it overestimates. So that's why I'm using that as an example at this point.
Can I just weigh in quickly on this? I think that there's a lot of feeling in the development community that possibly the latest proffer legislation has gone too far. And one thing that many of us that have looked or worked in other states have been taken with is the concept of impact fees. And there seems to be some willingness on the part of the building industry to entertain impact fees in the next iteration after this last thing of proffers. That doesn't mean that I think it's going to happen sooner rather than later, but just the fact that that is a possibility. I think that that's actually a better solution if we were to have that than proffers has been. So as Liz pointed out, that there are taxes that we can't do at the local level. There are also a number of creative development techniques that we're not allowed to do as well. And I would like to think that over time, our legislature would become more receptive to those in both those arenas. But I'd just like to go back to the workforce thing for a moment, because I think it's really important. And when I see a lot of faces that are like mine, I'm 66, in this room, I think you have to realize, and what we learn from the workforce folks like Valerie Palo Mountain at PVCC, is that we're about to see a revolution that, or maybe we won't see it, but fast food restaurants are going to be robotized. People aren't going to be working in those areas. Trucks are not going to be driven by individuals. Delivery, these things are going to change in a 15 to 25 year time period dramatically. And so that means actually that there are going to be workforces that we have now that we have to find new jobs for on the one end. And on the other hand, what we're seeing is a tremendous amount of telecommuting and working that doesn't need the kind of standard workplace to be in. We've heard some figures that are sort of outrageous about how many people are telecommuting from Culpeper, and when we have our next train in, it's going to be interesting to see how many more people we're going to see telecommuting to Northern Virginia from Charlottesville, for instance. So one has to look a little bit in the future. We're at one of these change points, I think, are getting close to it, and that's going to affect, again, the way these environments that we have look. But there's no question that we need to have, in the ideal world, if we ask what the youngest generation, the hipsters, the millennials want, they want to be able to work in the greater neighborhood where they live. And we have examples of people who are turning down jobs because they can't live, they can't find affordable housing. And I'm talking about young professionals finding affordable housing close to where they're working in Charlottesville, Albemarle.
Can I add, I was really remiss in not saying one thing about our community. We are an education community, and a big portion of that jobs situation is job training also. Many people say, oh, well, you have to have the jobs before you train. It's a chicken and egg kind of thing. But we do talk to a lot of employers that say they can't find trained people here locally. And so I strongly believe we need to expand our K-Tech and support our education. So anyway.
Hi. Yeah, I used to live in Davidson, North Carolina, and I've lived in other places. And this idea of growth and quality of life just continually come into conflict. Davidson's a community that has tried to slow its growth in much the same way that Albemarle County has tried to do. And it tends to raise prices, as everybody says. And then I've seen other communities where they get some real go-getters and bring in a bunch of businesses, and they're putting in all these plants. I'm thinking of places in Michigan that, years ago, all of a sudden they would get an oil plant, and everybody was all excited, and now they're sitting empty. And so it doesn't seem as though either way works. And I think people have to realize that you can't really have slow growth and reasonable prices, and you can't grow your way out of it without having unbearable density and having populations that don't fit the new economy that has just come in, and so you have problems with that group also. And I like to think that what we're doing here is somewhat beneficial. It's all you kind of can do. Like I say, it's kind of a middle ground in that. And you're going to have more density. I mean, you're going to have more cars on 29 and Ryle. Oh, it's going to be a little smoother, and then it's going to be a clog. I want to commend you for fighting a difficult battle, and I think that a number of us that get to this age realize, it's that way everywhere. You don't really have a choice. This middle ground, I think, works well compared to a lot of others.
It's a really, really difficult needle to thread. I am very much the optimist, and I'm very interested in looking at these small area plans where we have a place to live, work, and play, so people don't have to go out on 29 North to get to where they want to go. But I'm optimistic.
Yeah, it's sort of connected to that same previous question. I've always been bewildered by the lack of roads around here. It seems to me that this territory ought to have a beltway. I've driven around the nation over my life, in many areas, in most cities this side, have a beltway. And that would improve the quality of life tremendously. I don't care how many paths you put for bicycles or think you're going to stay downtown or whatever. It still would reduce the stress factor if there were a beltway. And you could force the beltway such that it did not have, you know, a lot of entrance exits on it. It would be purely for getting around. So I don't know why, in looking ahead for growth, which obviously is going to happen because you have the University of Virginia here. I mean, does UVA ask you people, you know, whether they can expand? I don't think so. And I've in 20 years, I haven't noticed that. But I really think there ought to be. I mean, we just ditched the Western Bypass, which I thought was a very bad decision. But I think we ought to have a beltway. I've seen mountainous cities which actually had beltways, and it really improved the area. So that's my long-term opinion.
Thank you.
What do you say about that?
Well, my opinion on that particular Western Bypass was pretty negative. It was more of an internal road that didn't... I'm sorry, what? I'm sorry. Oh, the total beltway. Well, that was a pretty difficult thing to get through, I would say, with the opposition to the Western and the opposition to the Eastern. But I think that when we had our long-term road plans for the specific thing that we did, okay, with the Rio 29 intersection. Thank you. I'm trying not to call it an interchange, and I keep slipping up. That was a plan that goes back 30 or 40 years. The first thing that we were supposed to do was increase that intersection to make it more reasonable to move traffic through. We also knew that the vast majority of the traffic on 29 was local, and that was a big factor. So what we were really doing was we had the Meadow Creek Parkway that was supposed to come in, that interchange that was supposed to go first, and then we were supposed to look at a bypass. But for a whole variety of reasons, which I don't have time to go into right now, we skipped some of those steps and fought over it for 30-some years, and then finally went back to the original plan, which was to get the Meadow Creek Parkway in and get that interchange before we did a bypass. The particular bypass that we had, I will tell you, would not have helped us a whole lot, and you would have been very disappointed, I think, had it went in. That would be my prediction of how it went in, because it was not a beltway. Oh, and I have one really, really quick story, if I can say it. Somebody who was here earlier, Sally Thomas, she's been a great mentor of mine over the years and got me into this whole gig in the first place. She told me that back years ago, they put some VDOT folks way out in Western Albemarle at some of the intersections out there and stopped cars and actually asked them, what do you think? Do you think we need a bypass around Charlottesville? And at the time, everybody said no. And that's one of the reasons why we ended up with the plan that we did. I just thought that was an interesting little piece of information. So I disagree.
I want to ask a question. These discussion points, number two, I have, I guess, short-term memory problems. Liz, in your presentation, you said, well, first of all, growth doesn't pay for itself. I get that. But then point two, local government possesses the tools to mitigate the negative impacts of growth on our taxes, but we'll need state help and tax reform. Now, is there a snowball's chance in whatever that there would ever be tax reform in the sense that the state would get by with less money?
So
because if it would not, then ultimately the per capita amount of taxes that we will pay, whether it's state tax return or local taxes, is going to go up. Is that correct?
You are correct. You are absolutely correct. It's really interesting. I didn't mention this, but there has been a movement on the state level for many years. Local government has been lobbying the state government to give us some of the income tax. And what our state legislatures say is, oh, well, it has to be tax neutral. If we give you some of the income tax, we want you to give up the BPOL tax, which is our business's license tax. And so, yes, they aren't going to do anything. At least the current state legislature is not interested in tax reform that ends up giving us more money. Now, we have, there is a movement, it's not going to happen anytime soon, to try to give counties some equal taxing authority. For instance, a meals tax, a penny on the meals tax.
But again, that would just mean that we all pay more tax.
Yes. Oh,
sure.
The money has to come from somewhere.
Sure. So the growth will never, in whatever mode, it doesn't pay for itself in any way you can see.
It doesn't. I don't see any way. But if you have more income tax, there is the potential of being able to do that. If you have continued growth and you have good jobs and you have people working and you're getting some income tax, you may be able to shift that math a little bit.
Since I have the mic, there's one question there, but I'm going to ask you one more thing before I yield the mic. You've a couple of times alluded to the idea that VDOT assures you that things are okay, no problems, whatever, but then when the things are actually built, it's very bad. Are you legally required in your approval process to take the decision of VDOT? In other words, you can't fold in to your decision-making your own experience with VDOT?
We don't have to approve a project just because VDOT says it's not going to have an impact. And they really look at individual projects. You know, how is that extra, 20 cars coming out at different times really going to affect the overall traffic? And it's, it's death by a thousand cuts is what it is. And so they have to look at the individual ones. We have, we have a wonderful VDOT representative here. I've really learned a lot from him, so I hate to be bashing VDOT too much, but they have their rules. I would like, and he's going to be, for instance, he's going to be with me at this meeting tonight about Tillman and 250. But no, we don't have to approve something just because VDOT said. What we do often use is if VDOT says that it won't work, we use that to turn something down.
Yep. Since the topic of roadways has been brought up, there's a recent initiative about widening Free Bridge. Well, that's already been done. It's presently about six lanes. And to my view, it's really treating the symptom and not the problem. The problem is that there is no way to get from the east to the north. About 10 or 15 years ago, there was a study, Eastern Connector study, and that pretty much is dead as far as I know. Is there any chance of reviving that so that instead of widening Free Bridge, you could get a good route from Route 20 out to Airport Road or somewhere like that?
I do not know of anything in particular. Do you know?
Yeah, we have an Eastern Connector now. It's you go to Zions Crossroads and you take 15 around. And it's funny because when we talk to folks from Lynchburg about when they were so determined that we shouldn't have improvements other than the bypass, they would talk about how they would get around Charlottesville. I just have to weigh in and say I think there's another set of symptoms that beltways are addressing. They're not getting to the core of the issue, and that is that we should be living closer to where we work. Obviously, there are exceptions to that for people who elect for the lifestyle and can afford that. But otherwise, it's the commuting world that we've created around here, for the most part, doesn't make sense. And that is what we are trying, I think many of us are endeavoring to do something about by trying to get the planning policies to allow for that to happen. It's if you query the folks who live at Lake Monticello or the folks who commute to the big box stores from Harrisonburg and from Waynesboro, they tell you that they couldn't find housing.
One more question, very quick.
if it costs proportionally more to provide public services to the rural areas than to the areas in the urbanized zones, wouldn't it make sense to reassess the 95-5 ratio?
I don't believe it would. I think what we need to do is be concentrating that growth and making that development area a lot more attractive. We have different standards for public service out in the rural area. We have for quite a while with respect to times, for instance, answering a fire call, those kinds of things. And that sounds pretty awful, but we do. There's a money reason for that. So I would not want to make that. I think increasing the area that we have to serve is only going to compound the money issue that we have. One of the reasons why we have the growth area defined was to protect the rural area. The other reason, quite frankly, was to save money. It costs less to provide services to a more concentrated group of people.
Okay, Liz and Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you.